From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Years ago, a friend who founded a botanic garden in Massachusetts took me to visit a landscape he had long loved and admired, one that was not just beautiful, but also a designated National Historic Landmark, and that was also a cemetery on land that was consecrated for the purpose in 1831. Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts is still all those things, historic, beautiful, and a place of burial. But in more recent years, its mission has also been one of environmental stewardship, and insights into how that has been and continues to be accomplished in an established landscape is our topic today. But first, these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com. Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
Today's guest, David Barnett, came to Mount Auburn Cemetery in 1993 as the cemetery's first director of horticulture. Today, he is its president and CEO, which he has been since 2008. Good thing Dave had not just a degree in horticulture, but also a PhD in ecology, since he has drawn on that background extensively in recent years to guide Mount Auburn to see itself as an urban wildlife refuge and a forward-thinking model of sustainability. Welcome, Dave. I'm so glad to speak to you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
It's like we're reunited earlier in our careers. I was the Newsday Garden Editor, and you ran Planting Fields Arboretum, an important property on my beat back in the day. So
yeah, the years have flowed by, Margaret. Let's not talk about how many years have flowed by, but yeah,
I've known
you for a long time.
So you didn't get to use
You did mention that I came here in 1993, so yes, it was before then.
So you didn't get to use your ecology degree as much earlier in your career, but tell us about when Mount Auburn sort of formalized the idea of emphasizing its place as an urban wildlife refuge and set specific sustainability goals. Like, what's that? When did that happen?
Well, I would say even before I was here, there was certainly a focus on it at some degree of sustainability, sustainable practices, but it wasn't. It really started ramping up, and you know, after I got here, because of my own interests, many of the other staff at the time as well, and we just really felt it was time to do more focus, spend more time focusing on it, and really do the right thing, and it gradually became more formalized in some longer-term planning processes. And when several years ago we did a strategic plan, and one of the top-level strategic initiatives of the plan was to be a model of environmental stewardship. So that's when it really became kind of institution-wide instead of just the horticulture department.
Well, because sort of in the Boston area, I mean, you're this piece of ecological uniqueness, I think I read in one description, right? I mean, it's an unusual place to have 175 acres in the condition
you
have.
It's such an important, more and more important these days, because we're surrounded by an urban environment, and you know, open green space that's good for wildlife and people is that much more important than it used to be and recognized as being important. So it's we're really in a kind of a unique spot.
Mm. So now, as with Central Park in New York City and other such spaces, like the birds, for instance, and you have a lot of birds there, especially during migration periods at Mount Auburn.
Yes.
The birds knew all along this was a great ecologically important spot.
yes, they have.
So tell us a little bit about the wildlife and who calls it home and so forth.
Forever. Birds have stopped by Mount Auburn. It happens to be on the flyover, the path of migrating birds, you know, coming kind of following the coastline from Central America and on up north. So we're right in that flyway, but in recent years, the more urbanization has happened, the more here we are. The birds are flying over, and all they see is 175 acres of 5,000 trees in the treetops as they're flying over. So it really is an obvious place for them to stop and take a rest and get replenished with food on their way north. But we happen to be in an area, in a zone that birds are migrating through anyway. And of course, there's also a lot of resident birds as well that take up space here.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that you have bird clubs and so forth that love to be there and looking at birds.
Yes, absolutely. We are quite a popular destination for many, many bird clubs and Mass Audubon Society and other organizations that organize groups to bring here, and then people flock here as individuals, especially in May and peak migrating season, but also throughout the year.
So it's not just birds. I know, for instance, when you did your woodland, you've done a number of, as part of this sort of overall mandate of greater sustainability and being more of a mm-hmm. wildlife refuge in recent years that's intensified.
Right.
You've done a number of projects. You restored the woodland, didn't you? I mean, you've been restoring the woodland. Tell us a little bit about some of the sort of steps, and what did you do? Did you kind of monitor populations and figure out who was there and what you needed to do to, you know, what's the thought process that when you begin? And again, this is a historic place.
Yep.
And a place that a lot of people have attachment to. It's an emotional place. It's
right.
a treasured place. So you can't just change everything, right? You have limitations.
Right. Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that. We still are very much an active, ongoing cemetery, but creating and selling and space and burying people all the time, in addition to, you know, generations of people that have already been buried here. So yes, we have to keep that in mind while we continue to move forward in other directions. But the woodland you mentioned is what we call Consecration Dell. It's really right in the heart of the cemetery, and it's where our consecration ceremony was held in 1831 when Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story gave the address and founded and described the vision of what our founders had envisioned at the time. You know, it was a natural woodland area, and he described standing in the middle of this woodland area, he described the vision. And, you know, 160 or so years had gone by and until from that time, and when I first came here, that woodland area had become more dominated by Norway maple and some other invasive shrubs and trees that had kind of come in over the decades. And we started looking at it as what can we do to restore that woodland. And it just so happened, as you say, talk about wildlife, right in the middle of this area, there's a vernal pool that has a very a population of spotted salamander that mates in vernal pools, and certainly in ours, and we knew we had a pretty valuable, ecologically valuable population of the spotted salamander that was a threatened species, and started with that salamander population in mind. What could we do to improve the habitat, and then start gradually improving the surrounding woodland habitat, you know, for that salamander? And of course, that quickly turned into really thinking about what we could do to improve the habitat for all the birds, from wood thrushes and ground nesting birds to migrating birds and warblers and everything in between. But it really kind of started with the interest in the salamander population,
mm.
while within, right in the heart of an active cemetery.
They're smart, animals like the salamanders use vernal pools.
Yes.
Because fish don't live in a temporary body of water, and fish would eat, you know what I mean? It's just so beautiful,
right,
and intricate.
Exactly. Yep.
Why that body of water is a good body of water for something,
yeah,
like a salamander to reproduce in, because it's not a fish habitat.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Or a
right.
bullfrog habitat,
yeah,
for that matter, probably, really, is it? I mean, I wouldn't imagine.
No, it's not. In fact, we had lost. We have since reintroduced. There weren't any American toads here in the cemetery, and there weren't any spring peepers and gray tree frogs. But we've introduced all three of those since, in using this vernal pool as the place to put the eggs to collect and put with all working with various officials that, you know, going through all the proper permitting process.
Sure.
We've been able to do that over the years, and it's really, the vernal pool is turns out to be a very successful place to do that.
It is. It is. It's very important. These small and sometimes temporary bodies of water are very important for the amphibians especially. So, that's why I didn't know about those other successful repopulations. That's wonderful. Yeah.
It's been very gratifying to be able to do that.
Yeah. Some of my
best. Of
course,
years ago, why
favorite.
Were they not here was you know, past decades of long before I was here, many of the people, you know, decades ago, the practices were different with chemicals and wood grass was being planted for amongst below the trees, even here in the woodland. The woodland had kind of disappeared, and then, but it's been really been great to restore it. And it's been what our goal horticulturally has been to plant everything in this 4-acre area, kind of a valley surrounding the vernal pool, is our native species to New England, and that's been our goal there in this area. That's not our overall mantra for throughout 175 acres, but in this area, we're focused on making sure we have all native New England plants.
Did you first? Then you mentioned Norway maples, for instance, and other invasive things, non-native things. So is that where, you know, those of us who are thinking about our own properties or in general, is that where the thinking starts, is identifying what needs to go, what's putting the most pressure on the environment and making the environment the least diverse, so to speak? Is that what you do first?
Yeah, I think that is a fair statement to say. You got to start there. We recognize that there are plants that are having a negative impact on the landscape, and certainly in this case, there were several very large Norway maples that are just so competitive and dense, and it's very few things grow under them. In addition to the fact they seed themselves and sprout up everywhere, and that's why they're invasive. But that, they were there, plus a number of Japanese barberries and honeysuckles and assorted other shrubs that have we now know are invasive, but back in the decades ago, they were very popular ornamental plants, and you know now we know better about some of these kind of plants. So yes, we started there and in projects since by removing the invasive plants, but with a plan to as quickly as possible replace with more suitable plants.
In some of the plant substitutes that I read about, I don't remember whether it's on their website or in somewhere else about Mount Auburn. Some things were just getting too big or out of shape or whatever, and in picking something new, you still had to retain, you still had to retain kind of the look, because again, this isn't just a wild place. This is a place with history and sentiment attached, deep, both are deep. So for instance, I think you had a lot of yews, I think, that are non-native, English yews, I guess, were they?
Yes. Japanese yews and
Japanese yews, okay.
English yews, it's a good point that we're largely focused. We have a large focus on environmental stewardship, but that's not the only focus and initiative. And yes, it's very important. One of our overriding parts of our master plan and wall planning process is to preserve the historic character of Mount Auburn. And when I say character, that doesn't mean restore to 1831 or 1920 or any particular year, but to really preserve that what we imagine to be the intent of the founders of being a cemetery, but also a beautiful and inspiring place for the living. And then over the year, in different parts of Mount Auburn, there are what we call landscape character zones from our original master plan. That the Halverson Design Partnership did for us way back in 1993 is that there are areas that best represent the Victorian period of the 1800s, where very ornamental, ornate, colorful kinds of plantings, and there's very naturalistic areas that best, like the Conservation Dell, that best represent the naturalistic and ornamental parkland and various other character zones in between. So as we do any replanting or replacement of plants, we are looking at the character of the area and picking plants that are appropriate to what we're trying to recreate or restore. But so that's different in different areas. But yes, as far as plant, it's, I think, the overriding concept is that right plant in the right place, as far when you go back to the environmental sustainability and stewardship part of it, is if you plant a plant that wants to be 12 feet tall in a place that you have to keep it to be 4 feet tall, then it's the wrong plant because it takes so much pruning and effort. And Japanese yews fit that category because they want to be a tree or a large shrub, and they're so popular as foundation plantings, but they're the wrong plant. So obviously there are dwarf cultivars of yews and dwarf and many other more compact plants that we have been gradually over the years replacing the larger plants that need a lot of maintenance with more suitable Ilex glabra, the winterberry, whether evergreen, there's globe arborvitaes as far as evergreen plants, but also Little Princess Spirea and all kinds of shrubs, whether they're flowering or evergreen, that only grow 2 feet tall or only grow 4 feet tall as opposed to 7 or 8 or more. So
right.
That's, and the same applies to ground covers, where replace English ivy that grows like crazy and needs to be cut back all the time with things like barren strawberry or Cranesbill geraniums and a long list of things that are much more easy to establish but better behaved.
Right.
And require less water, less maintenance, and all those kind of things. Yeah.
Right. There's a new project, I think. I'm not sure if you're fundraising for it now or if it's scheduled to begin. Isn't there another initiative? I mean, you've done the woodland, and I know you've done some other areas of the property, but
yes.
Kind of updated them. But do you have a new initiative that's kind of beginning in the planning stages now?
We do. It's called Indian Ridge Path. There's a long natural esker, glacial esker, that is a long, narrow ridge with a steep slope on both sides. That is what we call Indian Ridge, and has always been a very popular visitor area and especially birding destination. You're kind of up on the ridge, and you can look into the trees on both sides. But anyway, that's the area that we're currently fundraising for, and we actually started this spring, June. We started the first phase of it, so we're very actively in it. Where we similar to the woodland, and we started over the winter. We removed some more Norway maples and a whole bunch of honeysuckles and other invasive shrubs, and then now we're in. And then we started the first phase of the planting of more naturalistic shrubs, plantings of mast plantings of shrubs and perennials and ground covers and ferns that are now have been planted in this area and will continue to be over the next couple of years as we go through this phased project.
I was reading about it, and I didn't visualize that it was that ridge, literally that,
yeah.
As you said, it's a dramatic spot, yes?
Yeah, it really is, and it's always been a popular spot, but why are we doing this? I mean, it had invasive plants, but to the average person, it looked pretty good, it always has looked, and that's a kind of a little dilemma at first. When we do remove a lot of significant trees and shrubs, then it looks pretty bare for a while, and it always attracts attention. Not necessarily good at first, but except over the years, I think most of our visitors have learned that when we do that, it's for a reason, and it's for a longer-term improvement, both aesthetically. This gives us a chance in this historic part of our historic core to add plants that help restore it to a look that we think it would have had 100 years ago, but as importantly, improve the wildlife habitat value and the aesthetic value of the plantings. And that's exactly what this project is doing all of those things and improving, making it a better habitat for a wider diversity birds and other animals.
Right.
Part of a bigger, I should say, about 5 years ago, we did a wildlife habitat action plan. We had a wonderful 3-day meeting of experts in herpetology and ornithology and landscape architecture and design and meadow planting, et cetera, that really came and then studied what we'd done in past years, but then developed a 10-year-plus plan for additional projects to do as part of the broader, bigger overall goal to improve wildlife habitat value of Mount Auburn in general. And this project, the Indian Ridge Project, was identified at that time as an area that would be really help in that sense, kind of connecting our different areas, woodland. I'm sure you've heard over for wildlife, the more you can connect areas, give a bigger area that whether it's toads or other or salamanders or birds can might crawl through or fly through without having to cross wide expanses of mowed lawn,
then yes.
That's what we've been trying to do, is to connect the various parts, the ponds and the aquatic habitats and the woodland habitats of Mount Auburn, and this project is part of that broader, longer-term effort.
Just for a couple minutes, I wonder if you could tell us about, there's a famous botanist buried there who has a garden named for him. Can you tell us just a little bit about that? Because there's another botanical layer to this botanically rich place, isn't there?
Yes, and I would love, I'm glad you brought that up, but it's very exciting that we recently did a renovation of Asa Gray Garden, which is named after the Harvard botanist, Dr. Asa Gray, who really mid-1800s was right here at Harvard, right down the street from us in Cambridge, and he was really one of the American foremost botanists of his time, a contemporary of Charles Darwin, and because of his studies of herbarium specimens of Asian and North American plants that were being sent to him by plant explorers from around the world, he noticed the similarities between Asian and North American specimens and really was a big proponent of Darwin's theory of natural selection as it was being published or before it was being published even. And so what we've done in this new garden that we just renovated is incorporate Asian and North American plants into the garden in his honor. It was already named after him, and he is buried here at Mount Auburn. But the garden had become old and kind of needed. It was in need of a little bit of renovation. There was a fountain in the middle of it, and a pretty nice annual garden. But we've improved upon it dramatically, aesthetically and horticulturally in this botanical sense by incorporating these plants into it. But I think it's important to that's for people that are interested in that. We're also very much still an ongoing, an active cemetery, and then this garden is right in between our two chapels, and it's where people park. It's a circular drive around the garden with a fountain in the middle of it where the people are parking and then going to a memorial service in one chapel or the other. So it's also serving, and we really had this in mind all along, to create a contemplative, tranquil, spot, restful spot for people to sit and rest and linger before or after memorial services, whether they had any interest in horticulture or not. So it's trying to serve all of
right.
the different audiences, and so far we see it, we think it's doing very well. But yeah, it's the fun part of it from your question is the botanical horticultural aspects of it, in addition to everything else.
So in the last minute or so, I know this has been an unusual year, but normally you have a lot of visitors. We talked about the bird clubs, and you have people like myself. I visited years ago as a plant person. Can people visit now, or how does it work this year?
Yes, we're open now. We had to close for a while the end of March through April and through May. Where we were only open for certain hours for grave visitation, and we just decided to do that. And we were closed to the general public, but fortunately, in June, we reopened gradually, since July 1st, we've been open dawn to dusk, basically. We're open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. this time of year for completely open for visitation from anybody. Yes, but you know, and we just, and it's working well. We're glad. It was a tough decision to make to close, but like so many other people had to make. But we're glad to be open again.
Yeah.
But we are requiring face masks and following all the other protocols that are so important right now. Yep.
Of course. Well, I have a very strong memory of having visited, and I have to come across the pike, and I have to visit again and see some of these incredible and environmentally forward-thinking enhancements. So thank you, Dave Barnett, for speaking to us from Mount Auburn in Cambridge, Mass. Thank you so much. I'm glad to speak to you again and catch up finally after a couple of years. I'll talk to you again
soon.
Yeah,
well, please do, and I do hope I hear from you. I'd love to show you around. So thanks for
having
me.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. BrushwoodNursery.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening as well. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @AwayToGarden, and happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.